Hi, I'm Allison Hess.
And I'm Stephanie Graham.
Welcome to the Thousand Islands Playhouse Podcast. We have seven amazing shows to dive into for our 2026 season.
Join us as we talk to the artists that will make this season shine and get a behind-the-scenes peek at what's happening this summer, Dockside.
Don't forget to tune in
to give your ears a front row seat.
See you at the theater!
Hi everyone, Allison here. Just a heads up about our audio for this episode. The podcast was recorded over Zoom, so thank you for bearing with us as we worked through some internet and audio issues. But it's a great one, so enjoy.
Welcome back to the 2026 season of the Playhouse Podcast. We're recording today on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg peoples, and we're recording on Zoom today. My name is Stephanie Graham, and I'm the Artistic Associate here at the Playhouse.
And I'm Allison Hess, the Education and Engagement Manager. Welcome to our sixth episode of the 2026 season of the Playhouse Podcast. Today, we're discussing Ronnie Burkett's Wonderful Joe. Joe and his dog, Mister, lose their home and, facing separation, head into the world for one last adventure together. The world seems broken, but Joe sees magic in the mundane, beauty amongst brutality, and life in the lost and lonely. Along their fantastical journey, Joe and Mister encounter Mother Nature, Santa Claus, Jesus, the Tooth Fairy, and more. A seemingly simple tale of a simple man, Wonderful Joe is a love letter to imagination, hope, and the art of filling broken hearts with gold.
Wonderful Joe is the final production this season playing in the Firehall Theater. We're so incredibly lucky to have Ronnie Burkett himself zooming in with us from his studio in Toronto. Welcome, Ronnie.
Hello, thank you.
Hello, thanks for joining us. To sum up your fantastic career in a short bio is an impossible task, but we'll give a few highlights. Your company, the Ronnie Burkett Theatre of Marionettes, was formed in 1986 and has played Canada's major stages and on tours abroad ever since. You received the 2009 Simonovitch Prize in Theatre, the Herbert Whittaker Drama Bench Award for Outstanding Contribution to Canadian Theatre, a Village Voice Obie Award, and four Citations of Excellence from the American Centre of the Union Internationale de la Marionnette. In 2019, you were appointed as an Officer of the Order of Canada, and in 2024, you were awarded Canada's Governor General's Performing Arts Award for Lifetime Achievement. Not too shabby.
You'd think I'd be finished by now, right? But no. It's like, oh, do I stop now? Is that my gold watch?
Is that a hint? No.
I would hope not. We love your contributions to this amazing industry we're in.
Ronnie, first off, what is it about puppetry and specifically marionettes that speaks to you as a storytelling medium?
I think from childhood, when I first discovered puppetry, it appealed to me because I was that loner child who wanted to make things and paint things and sculpt things, but I also wanted to act and do funny voices and perform. And rather than having to focus on or choose one, puppetry said, here's a medium where you do it all, and you can do it all by yourself. So that was very appealing to a loner child. And that appeal has never waned. When I was in theater school, for example, I was sat down and they said, look, you will always be this height and this gender, and you will never be the leading man. So you will be the goofy best friend of the leading man. You can play 5 years older, 5 years younger, and you should learn to tap dance better. That was the advice from my theater school. And I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but okay. I basically gave them the finger and said, thank you. I've been on the road since I was in my early teens, playing the big bad wolf, the leading man, and Rapunzel, and the pigs, and the witch, and I've already found my medium. Thank you very much. So for me, as a storyteller, it is a perfect medium because I am not held to this older white male that the world sees me as. I get to be the beautiful ingenue, the old man's dog, the tooth fairy, and all the other characters that I want to play. It's kind of liberating as a performer, really.
And I know you also do some hand puppetry, but what was it about marionettes specifically? Because I know you also worked with some people who were more Muppet focused with that type of puppetry, but what keeps bringing you back to marionettes?
My initial fascination was with marionettes, you know, from all the books in the library. And my main mentors were grand old marionette men of American puppetry. When I was 19, I got hired to work at the Bill Baird Theater in New York City, which Bill Baird was the preeminent puppeteer before Jim Henson. He did The Lonely Goatherd and The Sound of Music. And he had an Actors Equity Theater in New York, and he hired me on my 19th birthday, and I moved to New York and worked for him. So marionettes were always this fascination, but lo and behold, I get to New York and people are like, we don't do marionettes anymore, because it was the great Muppet boom.
Right.
Same year, the Muppet Show premiered, and suddenly all we were all doing were Muppet, 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 Muppet. So I got sidetracked into TV work. But when I decided to start Theater of Marionettes 40 years ago, I thought, well, what can I do with puppetry that's new? And I thought, show people something that's old that you don't see anymore, which is the marionette on stage. And so I was able to finally get back to my initial interest. And there's just such an elegance and a beauty about marionettes in a sea of flapping foam everywhere, you know, in this Avenue Q style puppetry that we see everywhere.
I think you said that so beautifully, the elegance of marionette. I totally agree. There is something so magical, whether it is because you can sometimes see the strings.
Well, you know, the thing is you are playing an instrument when you have a marionette in your hands, and the control in your hand is 50% of the character, you know, the design and the construction of the control and where the strings go. And the longer the strings are, there's a delayed response through the strings. And so I'm always fascinated. I keep trying to get higher and higher away from the puppets just to extend that bit of air between me and the puppets, you know. It's a lovely instrument to have in your hand.
How do you think the landscape has changed for you specifically? You've talked about extending the length of the strings. Anything else that you're still challenging yourself with?
I think if somebody gets a long career in something, whatever that career is, easily the first half of that career is learning, you know, is learning technique, is learning the business, is learning how to tour, learning all the stuff. If you're blessed and fortunate and pig-headed enough to keep going in the middle of life and you get the next phase, then I think it's about interpretation, right? It's like, okay, now I have the chops. Now I know my technique. Now that's solid underneath me. And so that's for me been the last few years of what do I really want to do with this as a storyteller? Where do I want to go with the audience? I think as a younger artist, I really wanted to tell the audience absolute things because I, like young performers do, I assumed the audience knew nothing. You learn over time, the audience knows everything. Most people come in with their own vocabulary of emotional life and history of being a human being. So you don't have to preach to them. They all know what it is to love and be sad and to lose. So just tell them a story without preaching to them. I find that now I get to tell stories where I don't have to tell them what it is for these characters to be alive. I just have to show the life they're in. And that's very exciting right now.
In my research, you know, you have such fantastic characters. What is your process like in creating those characters? Like, do you find that the story you want to tell comes first, or do you discover the characters and then build a story around them?
That's a great question because it's both. For example, the Daisy Theater is this improv show I have, structured improv, but it's basically a big vaudeville show. And we started off with 20 characters. And we now have 56. And right now we're building another dozen for next season's tour. So we'll be up to, I don't know, 70 some characters soon, and eventually 100 characters just hanging on the back rail for me to grab and improvise with. The joy of the Daisy Theater is I can make whatever character pops into my mind because they don't have to relate to a script or a storyline. It can be a solo character who comes out and does a song, or it can just be some wacky character that I throw into the mix. So in the Daisy Theater, it always is about the character that pops into my mind. And I don't worry too much about how they're going to fit in. They'll fit in once they're built. On the other hand, a show like Wonderful Joe, which is a scripted show that has a story that's set with a beginning, middle, and an end, and it has its own design style and all of that, I tend to come up with the idea of the story first. And before I start building anything, I have to have a title, I have to have the first image, and I have to have the final image. Once I have those three things, then I go, okay, here we go. So there will be another big show, probably the biggest we've ever built, coming up in a few years. And I've said to my team, okay, one more, come on, because everyone wants to retire or go traveling. And I'm like, I want to keep going. So I said, we will build the show over 2 years, but this is what it is. So I'm already writing that before I'm designing it or building it.
Once you have an idea of this, of a character, like what is your process in designing and building that character?
Every marionette gets drawn full size on craft paper on my drafting table. So I draw them profile and I draw them front. And those basically become the pattern pieces. Now, a lot of people will do what the books tell you to do, and they will give you patterns for an adult male, an adult female, and a child. And you can use the child pattern for dwarves and mystical beasts and sprites and fairies and all of those sorts of things. But the technique I was taught was called counterbalancing. So what that means is there's a central line of balance that puts the character into their characteristic posture. And no matter what you do with the strings, gravity returns that character to their posture. So you're building in the humpback or the boastful chest. You're building that into the puppet. So that's the beginning, is sitting at the drafting table and drawing them that way. And from that, we take patterns. The arms and legs are carved out of wood. The bodies are carved out of styrofoam and then paper mache. The heads, if there's duplicate heads, because here's the thing, if a character changes their clothes, you have to make another puppet. And in some shows, a character has changed their clothes 13 times, oh, wow. Which means 13 marionettes. Even for a gag, like a character comes in wearing a coat and goes around and takes their coat off and comes out just in their shirt and pants, that's two marionettes to do that. Because once they're strung, you can't interchange clothes. So if we're duplicating puppets, for example, then we make a mold of the head sculpture so we can cast as many as we need. In the Daisy Theater, I sort of made this weird rule for myself that all the heads would be one-off sculptures without molds. So that's what we do for the Daisy. For the next show, there will be duplicates. And the lovely thing is with marionettes, of course, is you can do instant flashbacks. So you can see a character younger and you can see a character before the fire, or you can see before they died, or you can see them as a child. So that means a lot of puppet building, but it means instantly those characters are there and they can be on stage together, which is fascinating. Puppet building is a lot of work. And a lot of times it feels like a factory. You know, the most exciting time of building puppets is the beginning and the end. So when I'm sitting at the drafting table, it's so exciting. If we're building 40 puppets, for example, that's 80 legs to carve. And they have to get sanded. Then they have to get cut apart and jointed. So it's just endless months of building puppets. And at the end, when the costumes are coming together and they're going on the puppets and they're jointed and the heads are getting painted and they're getting strung, that's exciting too. And that's always like every kind of theater, down to the wire, people working till 3 a.m, all the mayhem that theater always is. But suddenly, a year after you conceive them, these characters are to life.
And you have a team at the theater, right, that works with you?
I do, yeah. I do the designing of the puppets and the clothes. I do the sculpting. Kim Crosley has made the costumes for close to 40 years. Kim is a cutter at the Stratford Festival. Mm-hmm. And we have a shorthand that can't be replaced. So Kim has done all the clothes for all the shows all these years. And, you know, I have a guy, Marcus Jamin, who comes in and does all the stringing for me. So we're a small but merry band. And a wonderful Canadian designer, Cami Koo, who is a brilliant designer on her own terms and has worked in theaters all over the world. Cami comes in late at night and makes little leather puppet shoes for me. I don't have a full-time staff. I often have a full-time intern or assistant, and they come in, and as they should, they go after 2 or 3 years, and off they go into the theater to do their own stuff. The best way to teach is to have somebody apprentice and build your stuff and to sand 80 legs. Once you sanded 80 legs, you know how those legs are carved.
You know, everything in theater is apprenticed. There's only so much you can learn from someone just talking about it. You have to do.
Believe it or not, my chief mentor was a man named Martin Stevens, who was a grand old man of American puppetry. And he and his second wife, because those old boys got married multiple times ago. Bill Baird had 4 wives. Martin only had 3. But he and his second wife did serious drama with marionettes. In the Depression, they did Joan of Arc. They did Cleopatra. They did the Passion Play with marionettes, for heaven's sakes, at the height of the Depression. But he, later in life, wrote a 20-session correspondence course in puppetry that I took when I was 12. And it still remains kind of the bedrock of my technique. He taught vocal work in there. He taught script writing. He taught how to write contracts. He taught how to build a counterbalance marionette. He taught a lot of stuff. And then session 20 was, you would write questions. And I never let session 20 end. And so I just kept writing him. And eventually I invited myself to his studio, to the point where I said, you have to pick me up at the airport because I'm on Easter break. I'm in high school. And he didn't really have a choice, you know. So
yeah, I'm here.
I was the apprentice no one wanted. I invited myself, and my parents, God love them, would put me on an airplane at the age of 15 to go to Detroit for Easter holidays to study with two puppeteers they never met, because these people had answers to things I needed to know.
Building on kind of your collaborations over the years, you work so often with John Alcorn, who's a fantastic musician, and your partner, correct?
Yeah.
Yes. And you've collaborated on so many of the productions that the Theatre of Marionettes does. What is that process like, working with John to create the soundscapes and the music for your pieces? Because it's a whole other language.
Yeah. And because we are partners, you know, we like to say there's been no murder-suicide yet. You know, that's risky business, working with the person you're also making dinner for. We're in one building here. The studio is a storefront, a commercial storefront, and we live in the apartment upstairs. And how it worked initially was I would go upstairs and we would sit at the kitchen table and have our meetings about a song for the Daisy or a score for the next show. And that was always kind of like too close to home. And the minute I said, we're going to meet in the studio, it became professional. So John comes downstairs, he brings his little notepad, we have our meeting, it's very cordial. He goes back up to his studio and I go back to work. And also, because our music is all recorded and because of John's status in the music world, we get the finest players to play on our tracks, you know, like Juno Award winners, an Order of Canada, who agree to play trumpet and saxophone and guitars and violins for puppet shows, you know. So it all comes down to the budget too. John will say, what do we got? Do we have a budget for 8 musicians, or do we get a budget for 2 musicians for one day to be recorded, and then I have to make everything else digitally? So there's always those discussions about what I want. But what I want to say about that, for anyone who's listening who might think of working that way, of putting music into their work, is the best advice John ever gave me was, don't sit down with a musician and try and talk like a musician to them, because you're not. So tell them what you want. Tell them what you hear in your head. Play them tracks of things you love. Say, this vibe, this vibe. That's what I did for A Wonderful Joe. I got some weird little bits of music and I'd play it at the kitchen table and go, what about this? And he'd go, oh yeah, send that to me. That's a good vibe. And then he'd go off and noodle about it and come back with a vibe, rather than me saying, I want something in the style of Arvo Part that's atonal. I don't know what I'm talking about, you know? So, no. Know the lane you're in, and the lane I'm always in is the character and the story. And that applies to how I talk to Kim, the costumer, you know? How I talk to Marcus when he's doing the stringing. What's the vibe? What do I want them to do? They technically know how to give me what I want. I don't have to worry about that. So I think collaboration is about honoring your collaborator's deep knowledge of their specific skill and not trying to tell them what their skill set should be, but instead saying, here's what I want. Can I have that?
All these beautiful, incredible artists in their own lanes coming together to make this beautiful thing.
Because it is a one-man show, but it's never been a one-man show, right? Ever. And that's got to come from the story and the storyteller. When I'm on the road for a long, long time, if I've been on the road for a full year, I start getting this desire to be in the studio, to not be that Ronnie, to be this Ronnie, you know, in a shop apron, not having to talk to anybody, just to make stuff. But after months and months of that, I get kind of antsy. I'm like, I want to go be that Ronnie. I want to go on the road. I want to live in hotels. I want that life. I want to tell my stories. So it's a perfect job for me that I can be both those things. But in terms of collaborators that you take on the road, even, you know, it's, you're not taking people on holiday. And so life on the road isn't even for everyone. So Crystal, my stage manager, has somehow miraculously been with me for, I think, 13, 14, 15 years now. And she gets a gold star for lasting the longest of any stage manager, because you're there to do the job. You're there to leave your family, leave your dogs, leave your favorite pillows, and to switch your clock and do nighttime work. But for me, it's the life I dreamed of. You know, Martin Stevens said to me when I was 12 years old, my mentor, he said, if you want this, you're going to be in hotel rooms for 40 years. What do you think? And I went, oh, promise? That sounds great to me. Let's go.
In your acceptance speech for the 2009 Szymanowicz Prize in theater, you said you hesitated to call yourself an artist, that an artist is one who creates a piece of work that cannot be discussed, only felt, and that you didn't think you were quite there yet. So 17 years later, do you feel like you are closer to seeing yourself as a kind of artist?
I do. I remember the moment it happened. I It was my 60th birthday, actually, that I was at the O'Neill Theater Center in Connecticut, which hosts the National Puppetry Conference every year. And I had been a guest artist there for several years. And I said, finally, I don't want to teach. I want to just come and make a piece. So they said, great. So I had 14 people and I created a piece called Crave, which was cradle to grave, crave, and explored puppetry in ways that I could never do on my own as a solo performer, as someone who has to tour the work. So it was a 20-minute piece with 14 people, mostly nonverbal. It was nonverbal, in fact. It was all music and movement, and we took all the seats out of a theater. So the audience got to roam. So once we made the viewing of it ambulatory as well, it just changed the whole theatrical dynamic. And I realized from the reaction that the audiences had that they had experienced something they couldn't verbalize. And I went, it happened. I made a piece of work that can't be discussed. It can only be felt. And then I said, I think maybe I'm an artist now. Maybe. Because, you know, at this point in my life, I'm not here to poo-poo on anyone. And that's hard because if you have opinions that are hard won and long won, sometimes it sounds like I'm trying to give a sermon from the mount. I'm not. I just have my experience. But we do seem to have a current generation of young artists coming out of theater school, calling themselves artists right out of the gate. And they're told they're artists in school. And I'm kind of like, I don't you kind of want that to evolve? Don't you want to grow into that? Don't you want to earn that?
Yeah, I think it's amazing. And I think in what I hear you talking about now and reading interviews from previous years, like you are a person and a performer and an artist who thinks a lot about these types of things. And I think that kind of introspection is important and not everyone has that. You've touched on many dark subjects in your work, including the AIDS epidemic, the Holocaust, but there's also such beauty and light in the stories that you tell. How do you balance these two elements when you're creating a piece?
Because I think that's how you balance your day. I think that's how you balance your movement through the world, through a life, you know. But I think that is life. I think in any given day, you know that that friend is in intensive care or that person is stage four and that friend just died and they just had a baby and they just got accepted into grad school. And they just won $20 on the lottery and their car just broke down. I think it's all of it at the same time. And I think for me, it's always been that way. I can go 0 to 60 on being sad and I can go 0 to 60 to being ridiculous. And those two things can happen in the space of 5 minutes. They exist together. And I think that is maybe the hallmark of a court jester or a fool who rolled into town with my bag of puppets to make you laugh. And while I make you laugh, maybe I sneak in a little thing that makes you cry.
Yeah. And when I think of puppetry, especially the way that you build your marionettes, they just have this kernel of joy and light in them, no matter the situation they're put in.
You know, I think a lot about puppetry. I think about it nonstop every day, all my life, to the point where I don't even talk about it that much anymore. But you know, these little vessels that I make them and I decide what they look like and what they're wearing and how they move and how they talk. The one thing I can't do is make them breathe. The audience make them breathe by the quality of their listening and the quality of their reaction. And so what these things have become to me are these little vessels where you get to put your frame of reference and go, I know how that feels. Puppets walk on stage and Wonderful Joe is Wonderful Joe. You have not seen him be anything else. He exists to be that. And he's saying, I'm going to tell you stories. Come breathe with me. I used to think I'm going to elevate puppetry to a fine art. That was kind of the goal. I think I wrote that in a lot of grants when I was really young. And I realized maybe 15 years ago, that's not the goal. The goal is for it to be a low art like Punch and Judy. Because no one expects it to be good. No one expects it to be life-changing. No one expects that little puppet to make you cry or gasp or laugh so ridiculously. And so as a low art, you get in because the expectations aren't as high. And that's what high art really is, I think.
Which characters are you the most excited to introduce our audiences to in Wonderful Joe?
Well, Joe, right off the bat, for me, Joe's one of the great characters because you know, he's charming, he's old, he's funny. You go on this adventure with him, his dog is fantastic, but Joe's also an old gay man. And I don't apologize for that. And I also don't overexplain that. He is an old gay man, which that is one of the most invisible things in the world, is to be old and gay. That's like a crime in the gay world. Well, he's really old and he's really gay. And off he goes on his adventure and we follow along. And it's great to just finally say, this character is this. But there's so many characters. At the beginning, you meet a couple of Joe's neighbors. And I thought, well, I took a huge risk in this play, a huge risk, because I realized I couldn't do a show that was set in an urban downtown setting that's going to be gentrified and just do a bunch of white characters. You know, that is not the city I live in. That's not the inner city of most cities in this country. And so I took a risk of making characters of color in this play as well. You know, Sonny, who is the building manager who has to tell Joe he's evicted, is South Asian. That's a risk for an old white guy to suddenly be doing characters of color.
Were there any other characters that maybe surprised you even as you were scripting the show and creating the show?
There's kind of two different little groups of characters. One are the street people that Joe knows. And there's a group called the Trash Alley Players who are doing a show. So, you know, it's a sex worker. It's an old rocker. It's a woman with Tourette's named Minnie. And Minnie surprised me because that takes a lot to just have this robust, foul-mouthed, elderly character go out. And she goes. And it's just so much fun. And if I worry about offending the audience, she doesn't work. If I just let her rip, she's hysterical, you know? So I have to not self-edit and be polite for the audience. It's like Minnie would not be polite. So there's those characters who are representative of lost souls who gentrification will get rid of. And, you know, one of my dearest friends on the planet has been a street level addictions counselor in Vancouver. And I would ask questions and I would say, tell me stories. If a sex worker lost their children, what would they have to do to get their kids back? So we have a character who is a sex worker desperate to get her children back. And so there's that bit of reality in these characters, even though they come across initially as odd and funny. And then there are the characters Joe sees that nobody else sees. So we see Mother Nature, we see Santa Claus, we see Jesus Christ, and we see the Tooth Fairy. And that to me shows Joe's magical ability of seeing things that should be make-believe. To him, they are real. And is that because of childhood trauma, or is that because he's just magical? Don't we all just want to believe in Santa Claus at least one night of the year? Don't we just want to believe the Tooth Fairy might put a quarter under your pillow?
That's great.
A beautiful way to exist.
Our last question, and you've kind of already touched on it, but you know, what are you hoping that the audiences will take away from Wonderful Joe?
I always hope that they will leave thinking, I wasn't convinced I wanted to sit through a puppet show and I loved those characters. Or I came here against my will and gee, parts of that offended me and got me thinking about the need for that character to talk that way. Yeah. I want people to leave fully invested in the story they saw and also to know that they saw a form of theater that has as much right to be on stage as Shakespeare or any modern contemporary piece with actors. I hope that's the audience leaving going, I never would have thought that I'd sit through something like that, and I'm glad I came. That's what I hope.
That's wonderful.
I think our audiences are in for a wonderful treat.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you so much, Ronnie, for joining us. Thank you for taking the time. And I was really looking forward to this one and to talk to you about everything, because just the way you look at your career and life and the art that we do. And it's been really lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very blessed. I've been very blessed to be able to work my tail off for 40 years and have this wonderful thing where people come and watch puppet shows. Yeah. You know, I don't take it for granted. So thank you for your interest, and I can't wait to see you. And I think also we should give a small round of applause to my puppy Percy for not barking once during
this. Good job, Percy.
And not dropping his rawhide bone that I gave him to keep him quiet and making clunking sounds. So Percy, thank you for—
good job, Percy.
For not showing up.
Good boy, Percy. Good job.
Thank you for joining us today. And thank you as always to Mark Hunt for composing the music for the Playhouse podcast. For more ticket information, please visit us at thousandislandsplayhouse.com.
See you at the theater.